Today is August the 26th, 2020. It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. This is a no-brainer. What do I mean by a no-brainer? A no-brainer is when the question is asked, the answer is obvious. The FCC asked for more public input on whether to let Charter impose data caps. The FCC reopened docket after the court ruled that Charter can charge for network connections. The Federal Communications Commission is taking another round of public comments on Charter's petition seeking permission to impose data caps on broadband users and charge network interconnection fees to online video providers, following a court ruling that may complicate the FCC's decision. The deadline for comments on Charter's petition passed on August the 6th, but in a public notice that was issued, the FCC said it is opening an additional comment period that will last until September the 2nd, giving people time to weigh in on the impact of the court ruling. That means you have 7 days from now to send in your input as to whether you agree or disagree with letting Charter impose data caps. Time to provide feedback is short-dated, so instead of telling you all the different ways of sending in your comments, I'll just comment on going straight to the website to submit your feedback. For electronic filers, comments may be filed electronically by accessing ECFS. Website is apps.fcc.gov/ECFS/. I will repeat that again. That is https://apps.fcc.gov/ECFS. I'll have our webmaster, Michael, post this on our website, pcradioshow.org. Thus far, there are more than 1,500 filings, mostly from consumers who object to data caps. The court ruling lets Charter charge new fees. Last Friday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit eliminated a merger condition that required Charter to provide free network interconnection to large online providers until May the 18th, 2023. The Obama-era FCC imposed that and other conditions on Charter when it bought Time Warner Cable and Bright House Networks in 2016 with the goal of preventing business disputes that have a history of harming consumer broadband performance when companies refuse to pay less demanded by ISPs. But in the current FCC under Chairman Ajit Pai, he chose not to defend the merits of the merger conditions in court, paving the way for the new ruling. The ruling came 2 months after Charter petitioned the FCC to let the merger conditions banning data caps and network interconnection payments expire 2 years early, in May of 2021. That's the earliest date on which the conditions can be eliminated under the original terms of the merger approval. Friday's court ruling seems to render Charter's petition moot as far as network interconnection condition goes, but the FCC still has to at least decide whether to lift the data cap prohibition. Charter is the second biggest cable company in the United States after Comcast, and it offers services in 41 states under the Spectrum brand name. Charter had said it doesn't currently plan to impose data caps or charge for interconnection, but the company recently tried to convince the FCC in a filing that home internet plans with data caps are often with broadband users. In a filing on Friday, Charter confirmed that it has complied with the network interconnection requirement, but with the court having vacated that merger condition, Charter could theoretically start asking online video providers for payments even before the FCC issues the decision. Charter did not respond to a request for comment after Friday's court ruling. This is a real no-brainer. What they're saying is, do you approve of having data caps on your internet service? The answer is obvious. The answer is no. So you have 7 days from now to give the feedback and add to the list of people that already said no. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and you can pick up the website to go to on the federal website to give them your feedback. There was widespread Zoom outage that temporarily halted remote work and learning. A widespread Zoom outage on Monday left remote workers and students unable to start their week of remote learning. This is a timeline of what happened. Just before 9 a.m. Eastern Time, Zoom said that it received reports of users being unable to visit its website. They also couldn't start and join Zoom meetings and webinars. At 10 a.m., Zoom said it identified the issue and began working on a fix. Just after noontime, Zoom said it was still in the process of deploying a fix across its cloud. Meeting and webinar service had been restored for most users. And by 12:37 Eastern Time, Zoom reported resolving the issue, preventing users from starting and joining meetings and webinars, and users also were able to sign up for paid accounts, upgrade, and manage their service on the Zoom website. This was a statement released by Zoom that they have resolved an issue that caused some users to be unable to start and join Zoom meetings and webinars or manage aspects of their accounts on the Zoom website. They sincerely apologize for any inconvenience. This will not be the only time that there will be teleconferencing outage. For many, it may evolve into an integral part of your long-term communication needs. I recommend that you plan now to have a plan B if and when there's another Zoom outage. There is available two other alternatives. Microsoft Teams operating format, functions, and courses very similar to Zoom. The learning curve to switch from one to the other is minimal. Microsoft Teams is available as part of Microsoft Office 365 subscriptions. Premium plans start at $5 per user per month and are subject to an annual commitment. You don't need to pay for pricey collaboration tools like Office 365 or SharePoint because Microsoft Teams is free to use. With the free flavor of Microsoft Teams, you get unlimited chats, audio and video calls, and 10 gigabytes of file storage for your entire team, plus 2 gigabytes of personal storage for each individual. Another similar offering to Zoom is Google Meet. Anyone with a Google account can create a video meeting, invite up to 100 participants, and meet for up to 60 minutes per meeting. And this offering is free through September 30th. Free users can host meetings for up to 24 hours per meeting for free. To set up and host a Google Meet session, you need to have a paid G Suite account, which costs $6 a month. And at its basic level, anyone with a standard Google account can join and participate in Google Meet meetings. Pick either one of these for Plan B alternative. Better yet, with some pilot testing, you may opt to use either Microsoft Teams or Google Meet as your primary teleconferencing tool. But you should have a Plan B in case there's another outage. It's not if it happens, it will. The only question is, we don't know when the next outage will occur. Chinese-made smartphones are secretly stealing money from people around the world. The phones are from the Chinese company that makes Tecno, that's T-E-C-N-O, and other low-priced smartphones as well as basic handsets. Since releasing its first smartphone in 2014, the upstart company has grown to become Africa's top handset seller, beating out longtime market leaders Samsung and Nokia. SecureD's system, which mobile carriers use to protect their networks and customers against fraudulent transactions, blocked 850,000 transactions connected to pre-installed malware on Transsion, that's TranSSion phones, between March and December of last year. SecureD said data was used up by the malware as it attempted to subscribe paid services. Along with South Africa, Tecno, W2 phones in Ethiopia, Cameroon, Egypt, Ghana, Indonesia, and Myanmar were infected. Transsion traffic accounts for 4% of the users in Africa, yet it contributes over 18% of all the suspicious clicks. Current security concerns about Chinese apps and hardware have largely focused on potential backdoors in Huawei 5G equipment. More recently, people have focused on how user data collected by TikTok could be abused by the company and the Chinese government. But an overlooked and ongoing threat is the consistent presence of malware on cheap smartphones from Chinese manufacturers and how it exacts a digital tax on people with low income. The company's Tecno W2 phones contain the hidden Triada and X-Helper programs. The company, in turn, are blaming an unidentified vendor in the supply chain process. But they're not doing anything about it. Transsion is the fourth largest handset maker in the world, behind Apple, Samsung, and Huawei. Most people are not even aware of that, but it's the only manufacturer in that group to exclusively focus on low-income markets. The need to keep costs low opens the door to malware and other vulnerabilities. SecureD previously discovered pre-installed malware on Alcatel phones made by TCL Communications, a Chinese handset maker in Brazil, Malaysia, and Nigeria. It also exposed how Chinese technology pre-installed on cheap smartphones in Brazil and Myanmar robbed users with fraudulent transactions. Chinese phones with pre-installed malware have become a major threat. People in the United States are also being exploited. Earlier this year, Malibytes, a security service, found pre-installed malware of Chinese origin in two phones offered to citizens with low income as part of the U.S. government's Lifeline program, which provides subsidized phones and mobile data. Both phones were made by Chinese companies. Cheap Chinese smartphones are a security risk to people with low incomes around the world. A factory reset doesn't take care of Triada and X-Helper. In other words, it's built in. It's part of the factory install. Typically, malware requires someone to be tricked into installing it on their phones, rather than it coming straight from the factory. It's often used to deliver invasive ads that send money back to whoever controls the malware, but it can also be used to install apps that subscribe the victim to paid services via monthly billing or prepaid data, siphoning cash directly from the phone's owner. Transsion said it created a fix for Triada and X-Helper after reports identified its presence in W2 smartphones. There is a better fix that is permanent and you have confidence it will not reappear. Throw out the phone and not buy any more cheap Chinese smartphones. Are you looking to upgrade your system by replacing a hard disk drive with a solid-state drive? Are you looking to upgrade your system by adding RAM memory? If you're not in a hurry and you have a little patience, we could soon see their prices drop to a record low, primarily due to an oversupply of NAND and DRAM-based products. According to a new report, prices will fall about 10% throughout 2020 and will continue to decline during first quarter 2021. In the publication DRAM Exchange, the report was that despite the traditional peak season for electronic sales and the release of Apple's new iPhones in the third quarter of 2020, the quarterly decline in NAND flash average selling price will likely reach 10% due to the client end's excess inventory under the impact of the pandemic. DigiTimes, which is another publication, also reports that the prices of memory chips, including NAND and DRAM, are expected to fall 10% in the fourth quarter, with a downward trend continuing into the first half of 2021. The reason for the price decline comes down to supply and demand. There's too much memory around, and manufacturers aren't buying it. Both Western Digital and Micron are just two firms that have slowed up their purchasing. Deutsche Bank writes that the data centers and other enterprise customers stockpiled their memory devices at the start of the pandemic over fears of a future shortage. That caused an oversupply, meaning less demand from customers in the coming quarters. It's not just the panic buying that resulted in the falling prices. Furthermore, suppliers continue making improvements in the yield rate of 128L NAND flash, and the oversupply in the NAND flash market will intensify in the fourth quarter of this year, further exacerbating the decline in NAND flash average selling price. The average selling price could fall as much as 15% in the coming months, and with component prices dropping, the products they appear in usually becomes cheaper too. That means we could see some great deals on solid-state storage and RAM during holiday events such as Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Prices bottoming out might be welcomed by PC fans, but it could spell disaster for manufacturers. Some NAND producers have been reducing supply to try and stop the decline, but companies that use the flash memory in their products aren't clearing stock fast enough due to the economic downturn. Since an excessive level of inventory has been carried over to this quarter, contract prices have inevitably turned downward. So if you are patient and you plan on upgrading a system, wait another quarter, and if you can wait into the first quarter of next year, prices will be cheaper. And that, in turn, by the way, means that new components uses memory and mass storage will also go down in price. There is standardization, and there is standardization. The value of standardization is the efficient means of communicating and exchanging information between different hardware platforms and software systems. Nowadays, with a plethora of devices being laid on top of networks for both home and businesses, you hear reference to the term the Internet of Things, or IoT. In plain English, what is the Internet of Things? The Internet of Things refers to a system of interrelated, internet-connected objects that are able to collect and transfer data over a wireless network without human intervention. With this technology, you do need standardization. However, in the haste to get to market first, many manufacturers define their own set of standards of how other devices communicate with their product. Hey Joe, please give me your 2 cents on standardization from your vantage point, 5,400 feet above sea level.
Standardization is a really wonderful concept. It means that once the technology is developed, then everybody can follow the set rules so that everybody, regardless of what hardware you're involved with, can follow those standards that everybody now knows what they should be. All right, I'm sounding a little confused, but it's understandable. I'm sitting here with a Motorola 7, G7. And you think that that's a Motorola G7 is a Motorola G7, but it's not. A Motorola G7 can be a Motorola G7 or a Motorola G7 Power or a Motorola G7 something else. And I'm sitting in a Subaru car, and that's a Subaru, and it doesn't matter what car it is because we have standardization, don't we?
Really, Joe? Are you asking a rhetorical question?
No, not exactly. Hank called me up the other day and said, did I see the new Google Auto or Android Auto problems and what they were doing with it? And I said, I had not. And he explained what the problems were. And I said, but I don't have that kind of a problem. I turn on my phone when I get into the car. I plug it in. Even before I turn on the engine, it has adjusted itself, and it gets the console running on the maps that I want it to do, and I can use the Hey Google command to open up Google and tell it I want to go to Walmart or to this gas station or wherever. Or maybe I want to go someplace I've never gone before, and I'll say to him, to Google, plot me a route to the nearest supermarket. And it will. It doesn't happen that way with his car or with his telephone, his smartphone. Standardization is a wonderful thing. We don't have it and probably never will.
It's bad enough that the standardization is so totally different between Apple and Android and each of the car manufacturers. But what is really getting to me these days is that each manufacturer of a telephone or of a computer or of a laptop or of a tablet has the right to fool around with the Android operating system and customize it for themselves. Now, what they will tell you if you talk to any of them is that that's how they improve on something, by improving it on their own phone, tablet, what have you. And that's how they get you to buy from them, as opposed to just buying based on looks or something. That's really, really bad. I see why they're doing it. I can't blame them for doing it, but as a consumer, I can blame them. I had a call the other day from a friend out here. There's very few places that can turn for help, and when you're in the high desert of Arizona. This fellow called me and asked me how to do something on his cell phone, his smartphone, and I told him right off, not a very difficult thing to do. And he said, called back and said, that didn't work. I said, what phone do you have? He said he had not just an Android, but he had a Pixel, the new Pixel. Well, the new Pixel uses supposedly the plain vanilla Android operating system, and I use the one that comes with a Lenovo Motorola. And obviously the two of them are so different they can't even talk to each other. You remember the good old days when you had two kinds of computers? You had a Windows computer and you had an Apple or Macintosh computer. And that was it. Hewlett-Packard and Compaq and all the other manufacturers of hardware made their variations in the hardware. They didn't modify the operating system. Yes, there were features, hardware features, in each manufacturer's format, but it was very different from today, when two pieces of smartphone have totally different interfaces and operating systems. Let Hank explain to you why that's a good thing, because he's never been able to convince me that it was.
That's Joe King for today. Talk to you again next time.
Thank you, Joe, and have a good evening. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. IT professionals do more than just the nerd.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. Yeah, that's right. I'm here. I'm your computer nerd. I'm an IT professional, and today I'm going to clue you in that IT professionals are more than just actually the nerd, the repairman, the guy over there who, yeah, he shows up for 5 minutes, fixes your computer, and disappears. Now, look, we have this vision in our mind that the nerd, he lacks social skills. He's highly technical. He's obsessed with science fiction and fantasy, and there's nothing more to him. As a side detour, I'll note that the top 10 grossing, top 50, top 100 grossing movies of all time, no matter how you count them, domestic, worldwide, adjusted for inflation or not, the bulk of the results are usually nerd-based. Star Wars, Harry Potter, all of the Marvel movies we keep getting. 20 Marvel movies over 10 years, and they're all mostly breaking even, depending on, you know, weird financial tricks behind the scenes, but they're all blockbusters. all of them. But that's another story. So there's a certain, just noting that you may have a certain nerd fascination within yourself. Of course, there's other nerd worlds too, like car nerds and Bible nerds and sports nerds and gun nerds and book nerds and all of that. Look, what a good IT nerd, an IT professional does is more than any would ever expect. Yes. As an IT nerd, if I am going to fix your computer, I'm going to have to know the technical side of it. Very, you know, that's my focus. But I'm also supposed to have good bedside manner. If we want to use a doctor equivalency here, bedside manner, I have to do this with good customer service skills. You're stressed, you're panicked, you're worried. I need to negotiate all of that and bring your problem to a solution. But you know that part of it. You've probably experienced it. I also have to use a form of psychology. I'm going to tell you about half of the fixes that I have done when I am working with someone have to do not with the hardware, not with the software, but with the person who actually made a mistake. And it's okay, but I have to determine what was likely broken by you, how you did it. I have to deconstruct that mistake. I have to then fix it, set it right, and then tell you carefully, very carefully, that it was your fault so you don't do it again. But I also have to do that without making you feel bad or incompetent or you yelling and screaming at me. There's a fine balance there. I have to do that very carefully. But also, we have to look at, I have to be able to go into the server room and fix something in there, something which may be affecting 50 or 100 or 200 or 500 people. I have to do this problem solving while being distracted by complaints, while being distracted by people looking for status updates, while I'm under caffeinated, while I'm hungry, and while I'm dealing with technical support specialists who may or may not have a solution for me, and also may or may not have the same culture or communication skills as I have. No offense to them. But we have all of these different hurdles and barriers that we have to go through. All of what I've just described requires problem solving. It requires patience. It requires perseverance. But that's not where it ends. That's not just the only thing. There's a lot of them. I'm only going to hit on a couple of these, three of these. The psychology side, which I've already covered, but then there's negotiation with vendors, which does require some psychology, but it's a people skill, but it's a different people skill. I have to be able to sit down with a technician, understand what it is they're selling me. I have to understand if what they're selling me is a ripoff or it's going to be successful. I have to figure out if the company is going to be able to deliver on the promises. I have to make sure that they understand my needs. There's so much there. And through all of this, I have to keep the price down, and I have to get into the entire mess of making sure that I don't break ethics along the way. Yeah, no kickbacks and no unfair bidding and stuff like that. And there's a lot of different ethics that different companies use and different IT professionals use. I hold myself to a fairly solid standard. Now, through this, that means I also need to know the financial world too. You may have heard of ROI, return on investment. There's also CapEx and OpEx and all of these other financial terms. And all of this money stuff that I have to deal with will contribute to the success or failure of the company. Lastly, project management. And that is so important. Large, expansive projects alongside smaller projects. And in some places, it's more than just one project. I have to keep an eye on the project I'm working on and the next 5, 10, 15, 20. Actually, at closing out one job, I was an IT manager, staff of two. One of them was me. And when I was closing out at that job, when I was leaving them, I provided them a 50, 60-page analysis of all of the project statuses, including the various success metrics, the barriers, and detailed expectations of improvement to the company. I had to keep documenting all of this. And this is part of project management and keeping an eye on all of this. I know when I left, I provided that nice large document. I'm sure there were things that were missing, different requests that people had made. Hey, can you do this project? Can you do that project? Of course, I was there for a number of years, but it's going to happen. So look, the IT nerd does do a lot more than you think. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What is cloud computing? And how does a cloud work? The term cloud, when talking about technology or computing, is not new. In simple terms, cloud is a metaphor for the internet. In fact, cloud symbols are repeatedly used to depict the internet on diagrams. If you think of the internet as a virtual space that connects users from all over the globe, it is like a cloud. It shares information by the way of networks. The term cloud services refer to a wide range of services delivered on demand to companies and customers over the internet. These services are designed to provide easy, affordable access to applications and resources without the need for internal infrastructure or hardware. Cloud computing refers to sharing resources, software, and information through a network, and more accurately, an internet connection. Information and data is stored on physical or virtual servers, which are maintained and controlled by a cloud computing provider. As a personal or business cloud computing user, you access your stored information on the cloud via an internet connection. What are the different types of cloud computing? Well, there are three primary cloud services. Platform as a service, otherwise known as PaaS, platform as a service, or application platform as a service, or platform-based service is a category of cloud computing services that provide a platform allowing customers to develop, run, and manage applications without the complexity of building and maintaining the infrastructure typically associated with developing and launching an app. Then there's software as a service, SaaS, and software as a service is also known as subscribeware or rentware, and is a software licensing or delivery model in which software is licensed on a subscription basis and is centrally hosted. It is sometimes referred to as on-demand software and was formerly referred to as software plus services by Microsoft. An example now is Office 365. Now it's run in the cloud through Azure services provided by Microsoft. Infrastructure as a service are online services that provide network infrastructure like physical computing resources, location, data partitioning, scaling, security, backup, and it runs virtual machines as guests. Pools of hypervisors within the cloud operational system can support large number of virtual machines and the ability to scale services up and down according to customers' varying requirements. Amazon Web Services, also known as AWS, Amazon Cloud Computing Division, has been the leader in the cloud industry market for several years. When it was launched in 2006, it provided only one service. Now the company offers more than 140 services to its clients. An interesting fact is that AWS accounts for 13% of Amazon's total sales. Here are some astonishing cloud computing statistics for this year, 2020 so far. The global public cloud computing market is set to exceed $330 billion, that's with a B, this year in 2020. Providing data access from anywhere is the top reason for cloud adoption. About a third of companies' IT budget goes to cloud services. Another interesting fact is that privacy, security, and lack of staff training are the top roadblocks to cloud adoption. And hybrid cloud adoption is at 58%. Who are the leaders in providing cloud services? According to Gartner, as of July last year, 2019, cloud infrastructure as a service, that's IaaS, AWS or Amazon led all the way as a leader in its ability to execute, but Microsoft Azure leads as a visionary, and Google is third in the race, followed by Oracle, Alibaba, and IBM. Well, who are the leaders today in providing cloud services 1 year later? Big surprise. Microsoft is far and away the largest enterprise cloud vendor in the world. Based on the last quarter revenue reports, get this now, Microsoft is bigger than Amazon and Google combined. They're 2 times bigger than IBM. What a stunning change of fortune for Microsoft. For the quarter ended June 30th, the revenue figures for each of these four cloud vendors were Microsoft, over $14 billion, Amazon, $10.8 billion, IBM, $6.3 billion, and a big surprise to me was Google at only $3 billion. There are going to be a lot more changes. There will be more changes, and at the consumer level, you are participating in cloud computing if you're using any of the Adobe products, and now many of the software products is in the cloud. They discovered that's how they can make more money than just licensing the software to you to run on your machine. The H-1B program. What are the facts? The H-1B visa program was launched in 1990 when President George H.W. Bush signed the Immigration Act of 1990. It was intended to help American firms deal with labor shortages in rapidly growing fields that demand specialized skills such as research, engineering, and computer programming. How many H-1B programs are presently working in the United States? 2,311,599, according to the Department of Labor. President Donald Trump has ordered a comprehensive review of the H-1B visa program, the primary way that companies in the United States hire high-skilled foreign workers. The multi-agency review is expected to result in suggested changes to ensure that the most skilled and highest-paid applicants receive H-1B visas. Change may be afoot for these tech companies now because H-1B visa hires are most often identified as software engineers or software developers by title, which isn't a specialty occupation in tech. The government now has started issuing more requests for evidence, asking them to prove that foreign-born talent holds special training or education that makes them uniquely qualified for the job they're hired into. One in four, I'll repeat that, one in four H-1B visa requests granted were for occupations that are commonly staffed by workers with only an associate degree or less. In fact, there are just high school graduate only in this program. Despite the requirement that applicants work in jobs that require a bachelor's degree or higher, visas are awarded to employers on a first-come, first-served basis, with applications accepted each year beginning in April. If the number of applications exceeds an annual cap set by Congress during the first 5 business days of April, visas are then awarded through a lottery system. So, how can you take advantage of it if you have a lottery system? What you do is with the big companies, they take their requirements and they aggregate them. In a lottery system, aggregating your requests will overwhelm any company making only small individual requests. And there are a few reasons to go through a hiring agency, though. For companies that also hire directly, they use a sourcing firm, can help them secure more foreign-born workers with varied skill sets. This is like a land grab for H-1B visas. A sourcing firm may also help with onboarding and how to handle H-1B workers at the end of the contract. By the way, the contract is for 3 years and renewable for another 3 years, up to 6 years. It becomes simpler for a company to simply disable key cards and let the sourcing firm deal with the other personnel issues. Staffing agencies are skilled at churning workers when the time comes. Currently, employers submit applications and pay between $1,710 and $6,460 in fees for each submitted request. So a large company can easily aggregate their needs and come up with the amount of money that's needed for the request. What happens to this money, by the way? The National Science Foundation gets a portion of the funds, and the retraining of American workers through the Department of Labor Employment and Training Administration get the rest of it. By the way, universities and colleges, nonprofits, and government research institutions are exempt from the cap, so they don't have to go through the lottery system. These uncapped employers have accounted for 10% of the H-1B visa applications. More than half of the H-1B visas have been awarded to Indian nationals. Workers from India receive the largest share, 50.5% of all H-1B visas for first-time employment, while the second largest share went to workers from China, 9.7%. Other countries receiving a large share of visas during this time includes Canada, 3.8%, Philippines, 3%, and South Korea, 2.8%. More than half of all the H-1B visa approvals went to employers in four states. 17.7% of them went to California, 14% went to New Jersey, Texas got 12.2%, and New York got 7.2%. And those were the top four states for H-1B visa approvals, more than half. Now, there's a controversy about these workers being paid less than what the American worker would get. Interesting information. The median individual income was $40,100 in 2019 in the United States. The median individual income of these workers is $85,722. But the workers don't get that money. When they go through the agency gets about 25% of that. Therefore, they make less than their American counterparts. Almost 750,000 of the workers, in other words, 750,000 of them out of the 2.3 million, earn $100,000 or greater a year. 960,000 workers earn an average salary of $90,000 or greater per year. The H-1B program does indeed need reform. The major abuse has been where a whole staff, like in Disney, is replaced, and in order for them to get their severance pay, they have to retrain the people that are replacing them. Who makes all the money on all this? Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation. Keeping your sockets out of your pockets.
Can you remember the days when we would often take long airplane rides and use our notebook PCs for all those hours of gate time and fly time? Some of today's notebook models can handle that kind of long hours without a recharge. Their built-in battery has you covered. But you won't be flying anytime soon. So how about using that notebook at home? How long can you keep working if the power fails? Hours or not at all? The answer to that may depend on your modem and your router. The same might be true for your phone, by the way. When the power goes away, does your internet go away or your Wi-Fi? Some modems and some routers have their own batteries or a place to put one once you know about that place and buy that battery. That and a flashlight or a candle or daylight at the window could keep you going for a while. But that point where your inside stuff connects to the internet is the overall most vulnerable point of failure for keeping active when the power goes out. The least expensive UPS models you can find are usually enough to keep that connection going and are almost certainly available at a store within a very few miles of you. The price range might be $35 to $75. Maybe a UPS. That's short for uninterruptible power system. Some people call it a battery backup. Maybe a UPS isn't a good choice for you. You'll hear about that in a couple minutes, but you may also want to consider two other options. One of those is a second feed from your power utility, one that comes from a different distribution line. If you're very lucky, and if you don't care how much it costs. One of your immediately adjacent neighbors may be on a different transformer. If you ever had a case where their power was out but not yours, or yours but not theirs, that could be the reason. If you're not sure, call your power company and ask. The answer is almost always a five-figure number. It won't be cheap. They'll bring in a second line and a second meter, and you'll need to buy an automatic failback transfer switch and pay an electrician to install it. That switch is a gizmo that chooses which line connects as your power main. So, there's a big upfront cost and a notable monthly cost. Generally, this kind of choice makes the most sense when there's so much at stake that being without power would cost even more. Mission-critical computing centers and manufacturing facilities are more likely to get this kind of dual feed than a residence. In a way, a generator can be your second source too, except that your failback electrical service is coming from something that's running in your yard. Generators that can handle all the electrical needs of a whole house cost thousands of dollars, need a similar failback transfer switch installed by an electrician, and there's a need for ongoing maintenance. That said, it can be a big one-time investment and not much after, or a whole bunch after. Don't bother telling me what you'd rather deal with, I get it. But what you may not get is that the overwhelmingly biggest seller of residential backup generators builds in mandatory annual fees, so you end up over the years paying significantly more than the cost of the equipment. And about that equipment, really, it's mostly a car engine, modified to run on natural gas if you have it, or some variety of tanked fuel if you don't. It connects to an alternator and some control electronics. Some manufacturers even build in that automatic transfer switch, but if memory serves, I believe the big guys don't throw that in. It's an add-on cost from them. That's a business model, one that I don't like because it feels like gouging. But they got big and successful with it. Challenge them about it and they'll explain how critical it is to have periodic maintenance done on the generator. Yeah, sure is. Oil filter, air filter, and spark plugs. If you're committed to getting a generator, generators are a good alternative for backup power, but you really want to do a lot of research and talk to a lot of people, objective people, not salespeople who just might let their paychecks influence their opinions. So, a second power feed from the utility or a second power feed from your own generator, too expensive but potentially full power solutions. Where do UPS battery backups fit into the plan? Start by asking yourself if there's really anything you need to power during an outage. If you keep the refrigerator door closed, your food can stay cold enough for a good many hours. If you're on municipal water and those pumps are still working, you have cold running water and can wash hands and flush toilets. Of course, if you're on a well, nope, sorry, neither. Cooking? Few stoves or ovens will let you light them with no power. Those are all things beyond what a UPS can handle. If, instead of a notebook, you have a computer with a system case and a separate monitor, a UPS can keep those going for at least a few minutes and at most a few hours. You'll make your own decisions about a UPS, but the jargon can get in the way. Here's a quick interpreter. The most expensive UPS systems never stop running, also meaning never stop making noise. These are called continuous duty or online UPS systems. They are always what's generating the power that run what you plug into them. They always get that power from their batteries. And as long as there's no power outage, the plug on the wall is always keeping those batteries charged. Almost without exception, the power they generate is true sine wave power. Glamorous, huh? Well, that's overkill for what most people need. The next step down is called line interactive. Normally, they pass power from the wall socket through to whatever you plug into them. If the power at the wall gets wacky, they can shift it back to normal ranges using what's called buck and boost circuits, all without tapping their batteries and without producing replacement power themselves. If the power swings way out of range, or goes away, they stop passing along wall plug power and immediately switch into their battery backup duties. The best line interactive UPS products also produce true sine wave power, just like the utilities provide. They cost several times more than line interactive products that produce what the makers want to call simulated sine waves, but what you and I might call fake sine waves. They're square waves, produced in a pattern that somewhat mimics sine waves. They don't do it really well, just somewhat well. A third type, the least expensive, is the standby UPS. Almost without exception, the power they produce is fake sine waves. If the power at the plug gets a little wacky, they don't try to adjust it. They just switch into using their batteries to produce power. You can figure this out. If the utility power at your place is often abnormal, a standby supply may use up its batteries before an outage hits. That's when line interactive is a better choice. And unless you're trying to power some really old gear, the odds are that the switch from standby to online is so quick that the gear never knows it happened. Overall, the switching happens roughly 4 times faster than the protected gear's power supply can see that the power is missing. Standby and line interactive are both that fast. In terms of sine wave, there isn't much in electronics where it makes a difference anymore. Maybe high-end audio systems, which you'd be silly to run from a UPS anyway. At the same time, there may be some simple little things that plug into cheaply made AC adapters, and those may overheat or worse if you feed them a fake sine wave. The rule of thumb here is that if it isn't yet 3 to 5 years old, it's probably okay. So again, the major UPS categories and choices are continuous online, or line interactive, or standby. True sine wave or fake sine wave. Start with those decisions and it will simplify your search for the right UPS. But we'll go more deeply into good UPS choices in another segment. And you may want a UPS even if you get a generator, just enough of one to cover the short span of time it takes for a generator to start up, get up to speed, and come online. Next time, when's the last time you used a meter to check a battery? Do you own a multimeter? Do you know how to use it? When you do, it's a really handy way to tell a lot about electrical and electronic values, like whether a USB charging port is up to snuff. These days, being hands-on with simple electronic test equipment is a lot less common than it was for your parents or grandparents, but it's easy to learn and has a lot to offer. Join us for How Not to Be Afraid of Test Gear. And yes, there may be a test.
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have been holding their general monthly meetings via teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club listed on our website, pcradioshow.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group, BCUG, will have a presentation on computer gaming for everyone, Thursday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is pcug.com, RSVP for meeting ID. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on connecting Internet of Things to your home or small business network. Thursday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org for RSVP to get a meeting ID. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey. They meet Friday, September the 11th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. Website is acgnj.org, RSVP for meeting ID. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.